Welcome, everyone. We're excited to welcome you for this. This is an important discussion this morning. Rabbi Yoni Rosenzweig has been here all week in Los Angeles. It's really been incredible to see how each of his talks, first of all, the content has been so moving and incredibly enriching. And the turnout has been consistently, packed every time he's spoken. And that's because he's been speaking about one of his primary areas that he speaks on lately, which is mental health. That's where he has his recent Sefer on mental health and halacha, and people really want to talk about the important issues related to mental health, mental wellness, mental illness. And when we were preparing this week here, Rabbi Rosenzweig said, I could talk about other things too. There's other things besides for mental health. And we thought, yeah, let's do for Sunday morning. Another one of the areas that Rabbi Rosenzweig is very involved with and also an expert in relates to agunot and gittin and, helping to ensure that people are able to get out of marriages that they need to get out of and want to get out of, and what are the halachic issues. So that was the plan. Then, of course, the war in Israel is on all of our minds, and it's, we thought, we should be focusing especially on things that are relevant. But then I noticed that there's also some controversy happening in Israel lately related to gittin and agunot as issues that could arise with soldiers going to war. So then I realized that this topic actually remains relevant. And so we'll be able to hear from Rabbi Rosenzweig a general overview of the topic so we can understand what are the issues involved in this very important topic. And then also, how is this relevant right now today? Hopefully it won't become relevant, but it's on the minds of poskim and rabbis in Israel today. And so we'll get to understand what are the issues behind it and what are the discussions and what's going on. So I think a really important conversation. And as we mentioned before, Rabbi Rosenzweig's organization, Maglei Nefesh, is really doing important work in Israel. He's on the front lines in Israel. He's Israeli, lives in Israel. He's here with us this week. But going back to his family today, there are some flyers in the back. I think I saw in the back of the shul by the front door. If you want to hear more about his organization, Maglei Nefesh, you can get those there. But in the meantime, the final lecture of his week of talks throughout Los Angeles. So we thank Rabbi Rosenzweig and turn it over to him. Please help me welcome Rabbi Yonatan Rosenzweig.
Thank you. Is it okay if I stay seated? That's fine. No one. Okay. Thank you very much. I want to just really. This is the smallest forum that I've spoken in. So in a sense, it's not good that this is when I'm saying this. But I really want to thank Rabbi Jason Weiner for his all his work in bringing me out. His flexibility. I kept him guessing until the last moment whether I was coming or not, and he was very, very kind in all of that. So I really, really want to thank him. And if I'm already doing thanks, I should thank Ronnie Nagel as well and his wife for hosting me. I really, really appreciate it. They basically didn't see me. I was like a ghost the entire stay, just coming in and out, and it took that very well. So
you don't trust our kashrus.
really thank you very, very much. What we're going to do is, I'm going to first present the problem. Okay, that's not going to take too long. I'm then going to give you a lay of the land. I'm going to present the solutions to the problem, possible solutions that are out there. And then I'm going to finish with talking a little bit about the war and what that brings out in terms of this topic. But feel free to ask questions. I guess it's best to do that at the end. But if you have something pressing as I speak, then feel free to interject as well.
This year being recorded,
yes.
And you're
going to
go out and get
out. Yes. Okay. Right, we're recording. We're good? Okay. Let's start with the problem, okay? Sometimes people believe that rabbis can make the aguna problem just kind of like go away, and they give examples also from Prosbul and Shemitah and Heter Iska in terms of, rebate, in terms of interest and all kinds of things, and they say, why isn't there an easy workaround in terms of the aguna crisis? Why can't there be like an easy halachic thing that people can just do? Now, there are halachic tools, and we'll talk about them, but why isn't there something like so simple or easy, like mechirat chametz, or whatever it is? The answer to this question is that there's a problem. Marriage is not just a legal reality, it's just a reality. What do I mean by that? So sometimes people say to me, what if I told you it was pikuach nefesh? That if the woman doesn't get divorced, then the husband will beat her or whatever it is, to the extent that, she'll die or this or that, or she'll commit suicide. Then would you just say She's no longer married. Can you just like snap your fingers and say she's no longer married? So obviously, because you say pikuach nefesh is doche everything, pikuach nefesh. So the problem here is, and this is what you need to understand, is that if it's true that pikuach nefesh pushes everything aside, that's true, that's true. But it cannot change reality. Even pikuach nefesh, even a life-threatening situation cannot change. If I told you that because of pikuach nefesh, I want to change Shabbos to Tuesday, I think you'd say that's ridiculous. I think you'd say no amount of pikuach nefesh can change the reality that Shabbos is Shabbos. It's just the reality. You know, you may say because of pikuach nefesh we shouldn't keep the halachics of Shabbos. Okay, that's a different question. Meaning, can we say on Shabbos it is Shabbos, but I don't have to keep it because of pikuach nefesh? But you can't change the reality that the seventh day is the seventh day, period. In the same way, when a woman tells me, and this goes to my mental health work, that because of hydrophobia, she can't put her head underwater, so she can't go to mikvah, I don't have a workaround for that. The reality is she needs to put her head underwater. And if there is no, so I can't turn, if she got her period, if she is menstruating, if she is nida, that's a reality. Not just a halachic reality, it's just a reality that happened. And so to fix that reality, she needs to go to the mikvah. There is no workaround to the reality. So that's why also with aguna issues, we can tackle the halachics with halachic workarounds. We can't tackle the reality with halachic workarounds. Meaning if she's married, she's married. Now you want to annul the marriage. Now we have to use halachics to attack the halachics. But we can't just snap our fingers and say she's no longer married. Something has to happen. A get needs to be given. An annulment needs to happen. Something needs to happen to tackle the halachics which created that reality. But otherwise, the reality simply stands, and no amount of sorrow, distress, pain, pikuach nefesh even, can change that. Okay? So, is that clear? That's why that's not as simple as saying, you know, oh, but there's a significant amount of distress. There's more to it than that. Yeah. Including domestic violence. With all the sorrow, of course, once again, and we have to get her out of there, and I think that there are ways, you know, definitely halachic ways to do it, right? But I'm just pointing out that there does need to be a halachic solution that needs to be presented. You can't simply, like we do with many cases, like we'll say, well, you know, like in the war, we'll say the soldiers, you know, they need bulletproof vests, so we can drive those vests to them even on Shabbos, yeah? And we'll be over d'oraitas and we'll do whatever we need to do. Why? Not because we're making Shabbos go away. Shabbos still exists. However, for this purpose, we say it's allowed. So we're not conflicting with the reality. We're simply saying the reality is irrelevant to the situation, right? So a comparable situation would be if a woman said, you know, due to the fact that I'm, you know, not in a good relationship with my husband, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, can I, let's say, sleep with someone else? You know? Okay, so that would be an example, right, of her trying to say, maybe the laws that govern my marriage are on hold because of my situation. Just like the laws of Shabbos are on hold because of the situation. Of course, the answer there would be no, because we say that if there are three things that Pikuach Nefesh doesn't apply to, it's Gilui Arayot, Shficha Damim, and Avodah Zarah. So therefore, it's a problem to tell her, you know, that she could like now be with someone else, live with someone else, sleep with someone else. You know, it's not so simple because actually there, Pikuach Nefesh doesn't actually abrogate the law. But the point is that that's the difference between what some people are saying and what we need to understand about this field. This field is not as simple as recognizing the distress and then, so to speak, waving a magic halachic wand to simply make the problem go away, like we do with other scenarios where the distress is great or even to the extent of life-threatening. Is that clear? That's why we need to talk about the halachics.
So can you distinguish more between what you're speaking about now and, let's say, Cruz Bowl or Hazar Iska? Like, in what way, I want to clarify the reality versus halachics. Cruz Bowl is not a reality question. That's a lot, like, clarify those two.
So,
like, in the past...
And then we'll try to keep the questions
there. Okay. Okay.
It's being recorded. It's extremely difficult to hear this. And I listen to a lot of stuff on recording when questions come in. It's extremely disruptive.
Okay.
Personal favorite.
So,
hold the questions to the
end. Hold the questions to the end.
Get
fine.
Out what you want to say and then stop the recording if you want.
Good idea. Good idea.
It really is a good idea. I promise.
Okay. Thank you.
From someone who uses recording.
Okay. 100%. So I'll just say, right?
Yeah.
So okay. You know what? I'll go into the thing, and then you'll see the comparison. So therefore, that's the problem. Okay. That's where we stand, and that's why rabbis have such issues, in a sense, with fixing this issue or simply getting around it. It's not as simple as that. We do need to create a specific halachic technical tool in order to be able to deal with the issues. Now, the tools basically divide into two, okay? Some of them are after the fact, and some of them are preventative before the fact, okay? Let's talk about the ones that are after the fact, which are more complex, but let's get those out of the way, and then we'll go to the ones that I think are more familiar, which are before the fact, okay? Preventative. So after the fact, right? If a woman is married and she's in a situation, what tools are there for us to use? So one of the tools, which is rarely used, if at all, is called Hafka'at Kiddushin. Hafka'at Kiddushin is basically completely, it's not an annulment. I wouldn't call it an annulment. It's basically disassembling the Kiddushin. All right, is the best word that I could use for Hafka'at Kiddushin. In other words, basically a Beitin comes, Hafka'at with a Kuf, Hey, Pei, Kuf, Ayin, Taf. Hafka'at Kiddushin is, in a sense, disassembling the Kiddushin. What does it basically mean? It means that the rabbis come, the Beitin comes, and it says, by the power vested in us, we are now deciding that this Kiddushin is null and void. How could they do that? How could they simply interrupt the Kiddushin in this way? So there are many explanations for it. One of the classic explanations is that when a person is Mekadesh, he's Mekadesh, Kedat Moshe V'Yisrael. Kedat Moshe V'Yisrael seems to be, in a sense, like an implicit t'nai, like an implicit condition in the Kiddushin, that I'm only doing this if my religion, so to speak, is willing to accept, you know, my situation. So in a sense, he's saying, I'm beholden to the rabbis. And if the rabbis say that my Kiddushin are no longer valid, then fine. Then we can invalidate the Kiddushin. Rabbis don't use Hafka'at Kiddushin. Why don't they use it? Even though it's mentioned five times in the Gemara, in different sugyas, and there's a lot to talk about what those sugyas are, but even though it's mentioned many, many times, the understanding of many rabbis throughout the generations has been that only a very strong Beitin can do this, like a Sanhedrin or something along those lines. I mean, we're looking for an elite group, shall we say, of rabbis. And over the years, not just today, over the years, from about 1,000 years ago even and more, rabbis have progressively felt that they are incapable of donning that mantle and of claiming that they are that elite Beitin, and therefore feel like they cannot simply come and to say, okay, the Kiddushin are null and void. There are, of course, here and there, little examples where a rabbi may invoke Hafka'at Kiddushin. It's not unheard of. Rav Riskin once told me that when he was still a rabbi here in the U.S., that Rav Gorin once came over and they were talking about some issues that were in his community, and that Rav Gorin did a Hafka'at Kiddushin. I don't know of any other source that relates that specific story. Rav Gorin certainly doesn't talk about it in any of his writings. But nevertheless, there are once in a while, you know, stories about this and that and the other. It is not a very well-trodden path, okay? Let's put it that way. And like I said, most, if not all, rabbis stay away from the idea of Hafka'at Kiddushin. It implies the strength of the Beitin. And if we're honest, besides, of course, us wanting to find the solution, you know, because we always do for the Agunas, I'm wondering whether the Batei Din really are so strong. In other words, with all the disagreements that there are between different Batei Din, you know, none of them are very acceptable to a large group. Maybe the Rabbanut HaRashit, but maybe the ones in Israel. You know, but it's definitely hard to say that any given Beitin is really a significant Beitin. Like I said, if we're honest with ourselves, I think that it really is hard to claim that those Batei Din are so elite, so success, so well thought of, you know, etc. by everybody around. You know. Okay, some people hold by them, some people don't hold by them. So, you know, Hafka'at Kiddushin is a tool. It is mentioned in the Gemara. It's not really used. The next thing that we can talk about is Bitul Kiddushin. Bitul Kiddushin is, another term for it is Mekach Taot. And that is maybe a little bit more well known. Bitul Kiddushin is a form of an annulment. Okay? In other words, to be clear, Hafka'at Kiddushin basically comes and says, we are now ending this marriage. But a Bitul Kiddushin goes back to the point of the Kiddushin and says they were never married. Okay, that's different. Okay? The statement is not, from now on, I have dissolved the marriage. No. The statement is, you were never married, and I'll tell you why. Okay? Now, we might say, what's the difference? There's a difference in terms of how it's done. There's, of course, a difference for, let's say, for a Kohen, right? You know, if a Kohen is married, and then the marriage was stopped, so he was married, right? You know, et cetera, and she was married to him, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And therefore, if the guy was married to the woman, then is she a grusha? Is she divorced? Or was she married? Or basically was that marriage never happened? And then she can marry a Kohen later on, right? You know, so that, for example, is one nafkamina, one ramification, of whether we say hafkat kiddushin or we say bitul kiddushin. But the point is that bitul kiddushin is an annulment of the marriage, lemafreya, from the beginning. How is that done? How do we affect the bitul kiddushin? We affect the bitul kiddushin through claiming that there were things about the marriage that existed at the time of the marriage, of the kiddushin, that were never disclosed. So let's say if a person has, I'll give you an example that came before me, okay? So let's say there was a woman, she there was domestic violence, okay? And she was, and she wanted out of the marriage, and the husband refused to give her a get, you know, and this was like, I don't know, probably, I think it was like 10 to 12 years already, you know, she wasn't living with him anymore, you know, she had left him, but he refused to give her a get, and there was no way to force him. So she wanted to know what could be done. We found out that the husband had a previous marriage, meaning he had already been married once before, and that there was violence there as well. So then, in a sense, you come and say, if you would have known that in his first marriage, right, he was violent, would you have married him? And then she would say, of course not. If I had known that, I would never have done it. Yeah? So that wasn't disclosed. So you could. Now, I know it sounds a little bit weird. I'm aware that it sounds weird, because you're saying, wait a second. The violence that she's experiencing is not enough. But the non-disclosed violence from before, that's enough. Like, why is that enough? But the violence she's getting, not enough. Yeah? You're right. It's a little bit weird. I understand the discrepancy in people's heads, you know, but once again, you have to understand the mechanism, right? Of course, the reason, the impetus for us trying to get her out of the marriage is the violence that she's experiencing right now. Of course. But she's already married. So then how are we untying that knot? How are we untying this relationship? Okay? So you might say, well, you've tied because of the violence she's getting right now. That would require hafkaat kiddushin. It would require us to invalidate what's going on right now. And many batei din do not do that. Right? So what can we do? We can rely on bitul kiddushin. Bitul kiddushin doesn't require the strength of the beit din. Okay? Because it's not us coming and saying, we, with our strength as a beit din, are going to take apart this marriage. No. The marriage, in a sense, falls apart on its own. Because the woman comes and says, I was under false pretenses. The whole thing was under false pretenses. You know, so if I would have known, if this thing would have been disclosed to me, I would never have said yes. So in a sense, she's the one dissolving the marriage. It wasn't through the strength of the beit din. It was through her words and through her statement. They were basically saying, okay, so then you would never have married. So then the marriage is null and void. Okay? And that is the idea of bitul kiddushin. How popular, so to speak, is bitul kiddushin? It's a very big disagreement throughout history. Okay, like from the Rishonim, from the about 1,000 years ago, all through to the present day, very, very big disagreement whether to use or not to use bitul kiddushin. It certainly is alive and kicking, though. In other words, it would be a mistake to think that, oh, but there's like an overwhelming majority that's against it. Not true. It's about 50-50. If you want to like count names, yeah? So if you actually like look at all the responsa and you actually put them like, you know, in a list, all right, and you're counting names, there are definitely as many names, you know, who are willing to use bitul kiddushin as there are names that are not willing to use bitul kiddushin. One of the greatest champions of bitul kiddushin was Ramosha Feinstein. He had several tshuvas that he wrote very clearly, okay, probably more clear than any other posek in the history of Bitul Kiddushin. You know, he wrote very, very clearly that he does it. And I'll tell you more than that, is that I heard in the name of one of his children that the cases that are in the tshuvas are just a fraction. In other words, that there were more than that, you know, and that he wasn't afraid to use that tool. Despite that fact, and I think everybody here knows that Moshe Feinstein was an unbelievable posek with unbelievable integrity and courage. But despite all that, still many Batei Din do not feel the same strength that Moshe Feinstein felt. And certainly in Israel, I can tell you that the Rabbanut HaRashit, you know, sorry, another. It's not really the Rabbanut HaRashit. It's not really the chief rabbinate. It's a different system. The Batei Din in Israel do not use Bitul Kiddushin. And this I say also with some sorrow, like when there are Batei Din that try to use it, and there are once in a while, they are they're told behind the scenes to drop it. In other words, that not to use it, and that, you know, even if they think that it's the right thing to do, et cetera, et cetera. Why? It's a good question, why? People are afraid of a slippery slope, maybe. People are worried that it will give, you know, strength to organizations that are more far left, you know, etc. There could be all kinds of reasons why. I think Bitul Kiddushin is a perfectly valid tool. And like I said, it's not... the reason that I think that it's different than Hafkat Kiddushin is because Hafkat Kiddushin does not have a long history of being used. So when you talk about precedence, it's hard to find precedence for Hafkat Kiddushin. But Bitul Kiddushin, plenty of precedence. Really, until this day, like I said, up to Moshe Feinstein. I mean, there really are plenty of precedents. So there's no reason not, in my opinion, not to use a Bitul Kiddushin. Of course, responsibly and with the proper erudition and knowledge of the sources, etc., etc. But yes, I think that that's definitely a valid tool. So these are tools that are used after the fact. Okay, but we also have tools that we can use before the fact. Okay, and now I'm coming to that section. So everybody knows about the prenuptial agreement. Right? The prenup is maybe the most famous of the preventative measures. Ronnie here has an article by a woman named Rachel Levmore. Rachel Levmore was one of the original authors of the prenuptial agreement, the one that people use today, together with two rabbis in Israel, and they kind of like, you know, made the rounds here in America. She's what's called a Toenet Rabbanit. How do you say that? I have no idea. She's a lawyer in the Beit Din, so to speak. You know, like she would come to the Beit Din. She's a Toenet Rabbanit,
an advocate.
Okay, an advocate. Sure. she's also very learned. The prenup.
Is she with Nishmat or nothing?
I don't think at Nishmat.
Okay,
no. Yeah. So they created a prenup. The prenup took hold more here in the U.S. and much less in Israel. There were probably two reasons for this, okay? The first reason is that in the U.S., the ability to force the husband to do anything is very limited, while the ability to force the husband to do anything in Israel is more significant, and that's probably number one. If you don't know what I'm talking about, I'll explain a little bit. You know, in Israel... the government passed a law many years ago, you know, that you can throw a person in prison for not giving a get. You know, they take away his passport, they take away his driving license, they put upon him in all kinds of ways. And then they throw him in jail, you know, for, you know, could be even unlimited time, you know, until he decides to give a get. Many times that helps to convince people to do it. But anyone who's... Sarvan get, anyone who refuses to give a get for long enough, a lot of times tries to flee the country. You know, before they take away his passport, they try to get out because they know once they get to France or the U.S. or wherever, then they can do whatever they want, you know. And many communities, even if they know that he refuses to give a get, will accept the individual. He'll tell his side of the story, of course, and explain why he's in the right and, you know, et cetera. It's a whole thing. But the point is that in Israel, that once you're in Israel, there are more tools that you can use, and so people feel less the pressure, you know, to sign a prenup. The other reason is, in a sense, what the prenup does. So the prenup in the U.S. kind of shifts the power towards the Beitin. In other words, it basically says, look, when you sign this prenup, you're giving the Beitin the ability to put all kinds of sanctions on you, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So then the Beitin feels comfortable to present the prenup because why not? You know, like, the people will sign this prenup, and then as a result, we'll have the power to do whatever we need to do. In Israel, the prenup shifts the power away from the Beitin. In other words, in Israel, the prenup basically says, you will be beholden to the secular courts, you know, who can force, you know, a financial settlement, you know, and things like that, and take money, and this and that, you know, etc. And so the Beit Din feel less comfortable with the prenup because they don't want to lose their power and their control of the situation, you know, and therefore it's certainly more complex from their perspective. So, and there's a whole halachic thing which we're not going to go into about going to a secular court and whether you can go to a secular court at all for any issue. So it becomes much more fraught in Israel, which is why you will see many less individuals signing prenups in Israel. I always tell the couples that I marry, don't marry so many, but I always tell them to sign a prenup, and I always recommend it. And you know, there are many organizations that offer prenups. It's not like here. You know, like here, there, I think there are many rabbis who won't do the wedding without a prenup. You know, and it's few and far between in Israel to find rabbis like that. You know, like I said, for the reasons that I explained, it's less of a culture for whatever reason. So therefore, it doesn't happen as much. Rachel Levmore always says that the prenup is a complete and entire success. Not because it's ever been used, because it's not been used. In other words, that the existence of the prenup in and of itself, meaning the threat of financial, what's the word I'm looking for? I guess consequences is good. I was looking for the equivalent of a word knas, like a fine, but yeah, whatever. But yes, that the existence of financial consequences, just the threat of the financial consequences is enough to convince the husband not to put the wife through all that. And so, in her opinion, it's a complete success, you know, she says, like, you know, pretty much any couple that's ever signed a prenup, you know, when push came to shove, the woman got the get. That is her claim. And she usually knows what she's talking about. So I'm certainly not denying that fact. And so, yes, as a preventative measure for agunas, I think it's very, 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 very useful and very good, you know, to sign a prenup. Like I said, I support it. I also think that people should sign a prenup. If you're wondering, and this I'm really only going to be able to do like a little bit, you know, if you're wondering why anyone would disagree with the prenup, so the answer is, and once again, I'm making this very simplistic, but it's a longer discussion. Basically, the question is whether it's what's called a get me'use. In other words, is a get given as a result of an existing prenup a get that has been given by force? Have I basically forced the husband, or does the husband feel pressured to give the get? And if he feels pressured, maybe he's not giving it willingly. If he's not giving it willingly, then it's not a real get. It's a get me'use. Now, there's a lot of reasons why that's not a concern, and I really can't go into them right now because that would take a very, very long time. But yeah, the get me'use problem is the one for which many rabbanim, probably also here in the community, you know, would feel that the prenup is not acceptable. You know, and I can tell you that certainly there are many batei din, including the batei din in Eretz Yisrael, if I'm not mistaken, who before they, even if the prenup drives the husband into court, okay, and pushes him to give the get, before the get is given, they will demand a dissolution of the prenup. They will demand that the prenup first be canceled. So in other words, they will get the husband to the point where he's ready to give the get, but then right before that, they will cancel the prenup, they will cancel all that stuff, and then only after that will they give the get, because of their worry about a get me'use, of a get that is given, not out of the free will of the individual. Okay? Like I said, there are a lot of reasons to think that that's not an issue. But yes, that's the situation with the prenup. Other solutions, which are less less used are a get al tnai and a tnai bekidushin. Okay, let's talk about the tnai bekidushin first. Then we'll get to the get because that also relates to the war stuff. So we'll get to that in a second. Tnai bekidushin. Anybody who's learned Masechet Kiddushin knows that there are many Mishnahs that talk about conditions on the Kiddushin. Right? I'm a Kaddish you on the condition that I'm a Levi. I'm a Kaddish you on the condition that I'm a Kohen. I'm a Kaddish you on the condition that I'm rich, on the condition that I'm poor, on the condition that I live in the town, that I live in the city, that I live in... There are plenty of Tanaim. There are plenty of conditions that are offered in the Mishnah. So once again, a person might say, okay, so why can't we just sit, do Kiddushin on the condition that you won't beat me, a condition that you won't withhold a get from me, a condition that, you know, etc. And if any of those things happen, then the condition are null and void and finished. So there are, first of all, so there are two issues here, okay? The first issue, which you have to understand, is that there is a tnai in kiddushin, but there's not necessarily a tnai in nisuin. We today do kiddushin and nisuin, marriage, at the same time. We get into the chuppah, we do the kiddushin, we read the ketubah, then there, and we do the marriage, the sheva brachot, we do the chuppah, marriage, finished. Back in the day, there was a gap, 6 months, a year, whatever it was, between the Kiddushin and the Nisuin. When people said there's a Tnai in Kiddushin, they meant for the Kiddushin period. But once people get married, that whole thing is scrapped. And actually, the Nisuin, there's no Tnai in Nisuin. Like, you don't get married on the condition of. You just get married. So actually, all those Mishnahs that talk about a Tnai in Kiddushin aren't really relevant to the question of Nisuin. But it's actually not so clear that you can't do a Tnai, a condition on the Nisuin. Meaning, even though those Mishnahs are irrelevant, there are other sugyas in the Gemara that may be relevant to this discussion and actually do give the possibility of making a condition on the Nisuin. This also was a big controversy from about the 19th century. Why the 19th century? Because I think it was France was the first place, you know, where basically religious law stopped being the law of the land. And they started having, you know, the Enlightenment and, you know, the liberalism and all this stuff, you know, started in France. And at that point, little parentheses, okay? You know, it's very interesting how we look at each other, right? The Christians used to think they were promiscuous. Because before the 19th century, you could not, I mean, Catholics, right, don't divorce at all. So they were like, the Jews, you actually give an option to divorce. Like, it's ridiculous, right? We were considered to be very liberal in a sense and promiscuous. And now it's the opposite, right? People are like, you can't just divorce whenever you want to. What, you have to go through a process? Like, what's going on? Yeah. They're like, you know, et cetera. So, you know, the world has changed in that sense, you know, but today, that is obviously the vibe. What happened was that the moment that the vibe changed in the 19th century, husbands were just leaving their wives. In other words, they didn't need any more, right? Also, the secular vibe was such that, you know, you just have to get like a secular divorce and you don't have to worry about anything. So then you just left your wife and you got a secular divorce and you went. You didn't give the get. Like, what does it matter? So the rabbis in the mid-19th century started to discuss this issue, and whether they could make a condition on the Kiddushin, the condition they wanted to make on the Kiddushin, that if the husband doesn't give a get when he wants a divorce, and the Kiddushin are invalid. They wanted to put that condition at the beginning. There were all kinds of discussions about it. At some points, it was a whole brouhaha, and people, like, you know, were like all up in arms against it, and this and that, what's going to do to the... And people always talk about the sanctity of the marriage, or putting the marriage on, like, condition. It's not good to do that. It'll hurt the sanctity of the marriage. So people always talk about that. There was a lot of discussion about it, okay? Rav Ben Zion Meir Chai Uziel, Rav Uziel, which was the chief rabbi, the Sephardi chief rabbi in Israel, you know, right before the creation of the state, was the end of that discussion, in a sense. And he supported a condition, okay, on the Kiddushin, a very specific kind of condition. But he supported a condition on the Kiddushin, and he thought that it was possible to do. Many of the Moroccan rabbis thought that at the time. Morocco, for whatever reason, the rabbis in Morocco were very progressive. They were very interested in finding solutions to all these things. And they did. So he was also very supportive of it. It didn't take. Today, many of the women's organizations, so I don't know if you know all the women's organizations, Yad Laisha and CWJ, Center for Women's Justice, you know, Mavoi Satum, you know, these are, at least in Israel, these are the organizations. Here you may have other ones. They definitely support a version of Tanai B'Kiddushin, of conditional Kiddushin. Most people don't use it because it's considered to be very, I don't know, left-wing or liberal or whatever you want to call it. It's certainly out of the box. You know, it's not very accepted. But they do, they try, you know, to definitely put that forward as an option, as a preventative measure, okay, of having a Tanai in the Kiddushin. Of a condition in the condition, like I said, it's not very popular. Okay, to do that and consider it to be very much a little bit out beyond the pale to do such a thing. What's left? What's left is a get al tanai. Okay, a get al tanai is a conditional divorce. So I know this sounds pretty strange, right? But let's say imagine if your chuppah was such that the husband would give kiddushin, then they would read the ketubah, then they would do the chuppah, and then he would give a divorce, but a conditional divorce. Like right after that, right before they finish the chuppah, he would give it, and here's your divorce as well. You know, like, you know, al tanai, conditional, of course, on the fact, you know, that I'm not treating you right, that I disappear, that this happens, that happens, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Right? There, supposedly it solves the problem, but I hope you can understand that it's a little bit weird. You know what I'm saying? Like, it feels a little bit strange to already talk about the dissolution of the marriage while you're doing the marriage. You know, and I think that it would, and here, once again, those people who are against such things, against such methods, because of the sanctity of the marriage, because of what you're implying, it's understandable. You know, like, these things are a little bit jarring, you know, to say the least, you know, that a person would do that. Because you could say, we have to defend all, we have to protect all women, you know, et cetera, and we have to give, you know, a conditional divorce in that scenario. Lo pashut. You know, it's not so simple, you know, to do such a thing, to say such a thing. And once again, quite beyond the pale. I don't know if to say it's completely beyond the pale, or rabbis who support it, but for a lot of people, that's beyond the pale. For a lot of people, it's not acceptable. And once again, I've never seen anyone do a conditional gift. However, with the war, and here I come to my third part of my talk, with the war, this has suddenly become a lot more relevant. And the Gemara already talks about Chelot Beit David, Chelot Beit Shaul, the armies of Shaul and David, and when they used to go, they used to write a get and give it, a conditional get, and give it to their wives. By the way, that sugya is a little bit strange because the get that they gave was in case they die. You might say, if they die, she's a widow. What does it matter? In other words, what does it matter if she's a widow or she's divorced? Right? Sorry?
They don't know he died.
Oh, so that's what we say today, right? But back in the day, you know, from the Gemara, it seems like, you know, they knew that he died. But so then people say, oh, it's a nafkamina. It matters for Yibum. It matters for the fact, like, if she's divorced, then she doesn't have to worry about the brother and Yibum and Chalitza and all that stuff. But if she's a widow, then she'll have to worry about the brother, you know, and this and that. So she didn't want to worry about that. That's what the Mefarshim talk about, you know, in terms of what that might be, the difference in divorced and widowed. But nevertheless, besides all that, okay, the question is whether to apply that today, right? And many soldiers are going to war. And as Ronnie just said correctly, you know, we're not just worried about them dying, we're worried about them disappearing, you know, and we've had that, as we know. We've had soldiers that, you know, have been taken, their bodies or this or that. We don't really know what happened to them exactly. People wait and wait and wait and wait, you know, et cetera. It's definitely a challenge. The other challenge that we have is what happens if a person comes back and he's like not in a state that he can give a get. Let's say he's in a coma. Let's say he's we have the person, but he's not able, right? He's incapacitated in this way or that way, and he can't actually give a get, right? So the wife obviously will support him at the beginning, right? But then a year or two, three, four go by. And maybe she has little kids, and maybe she doesn't, you know, et cetera. And maybe she wants to get remarried, you know, and with all the difficulty, you know, that entails, you know, having. I mean, she's maybe she's 22, maybe she's 24, you know, et cetera. She wants to move on with her life, you know. And the husband, he would have wanted that for her, you know what I'm saying? Like if we could ask him, right, you know, do you want your continued existence to be saddling your wife? You know, he probably would say, you know, like, she should move on, you know, but he can't say that because he's in a coma. So, you know, what can you do? So then, is there a way to solve that, right, that problem? So we have two problems to solve, right? One is if he goes missing. Because once again, if he dies, the problem is not so significant. Like I said, widowed or divorced, there are differences, but they're not significant. What happens if he goes missing? What happens if he doesn't, not missing, but he's incapacitated, so he can't actually give a get in that situation? Right. So that those are the two things that are being discussed right now in Israel to a large extent. I will tell you what the general position is, okay? So the Rabbanut HaTzva'it, the army rabbinate, they obviously, I mean, I wasn't there, but they obviously had some internal dialogue about that. They have a form that they're willing to give to soldiers. They do not recommend it, okay? If a soldier asks for it, they give it to him. But they do not recommend the form. Why don't they recommend the form? And here we come into a little bit of psychology, and it's a good question what to think about this. They claim that it will hurt morale. They claim that it will hurt morale for soldiers to sign such a form. It's an interesting point. Yeah, to be honest, I'm not sure what I think about that. I'm not as worried about it. We do a lot of other things, like sometimes soldiers write letters, you know, like before they go into war, so like to be given to a next of kin if something happens. I mean, does that hurt morale? Maybe it does. I don't know. You know, but you know, you would say, okay, but that makes sense. You know, Rav Yoel Bin Nun, who is a Rav in the Gush, you know, he called me when I was here during my time. During when I was here, he said, you know, I know that you're supportive of certain solutions. I'm also, you know, because he wrote this big article about writing a get misha'ach, or not what's called, like a get, a conditional get for a soldier. And he thought that people should definitely write and do it. You know, and people told him, morale. So he says, you know, it's no different than signing a life insurance policy. You know, people do life insurance policies. They should sign this thing, you know, et cetera. So, you know, he sent me this whole long article that he wrote. He wants me to, you know, whatever. But the point is that you can definitely make the case. Okay, so Rav Asher Weiss actually spoke, I think it was like a 50-minute recorded talk that went out, certain snippets on it. One of the snippets was him talking about this. He was very much against, you know, and he doesn't say all the reasons why, but one of the reasons he does say, he says, he spoke to the army commanders and they say that it will hurt morale and they say that it's not a good idea. They're all against it. I'm not sure they're all against it, but definitely there are quite a few people that in the army who would say that they are against it, you know, for that reason, because of that it might hurt morale. But there are different opinions about this, you know, so it's hard to say definitively. And once again, I have directly received requests from soldiers, you know, for these forms. So in other words, they say, my wife is worried, this and this and that. Sometimes signing the form can put their minds at ease, you know, rather than, and I'm not sure we can say one size fits all, like that for everybody it would either hurt morale or boost morale. I'm not sure we can say one. I mean, it's probably case by case to some extent, yeah? And those who want it and those who desire it, I think that the army rabbit may be, you know, onto something, you know, that we shouldn't recommend it to everybody, but that we should give it to whoever needs it, wants it, you know, et cetera, and supply it in that way. And once again, there are two kinds of forms over here, but I think that both are fine. And look, there are those who will say that these forms... Sorry? Oh, yeah, so it's fine. Not at all. Thank you for coming. Thank you. I'm pretty much done. You got most of it. Nice to meet you. So I think that at the end of the day, even those who will disagree with the forms, so I always say, thank you. Even those who will disagree with the forms, I always say, like, it doesn't hurt. If it doesn't hurt morale, yeah, it doesn't hurt. In other words, let's say you sign it, and let's say that a rabbi says to you, oh, it doesn't work. Okay, well, it doesn't matter. You sign it. If it comes to it, right, a Beit Din sitting in the specific case might take it into account, might not take it into account, but at least it's there, you know, and maybe it'll help, maybe it won't help. Sometimes a Beit Din, even if it doesn't rely on the form, but it's willing to be mitzarif, it's willing to include it in a list of ideas that they may have, or a list of, you know, reasonings that they may have, and say, well, there's also this, and there's also that, and there's also this, and so maybe we can allow it, you know, in that situation. So even if they don't rely directly on the form, I see no reason not to sign these sorts of things, personally, assuming that, once again, it does not hurt the morale of the soldiers, which, of course, is very, very important during times like this. So that's the basic lay of the land. I think we've gone through just about everything. And I think with the time we have left, I'm happy to open up for questions or comments. Yeah.
I've heard that sometimes they go and find that the witnesses were not kosher, and then they can sort of consider
okay. There
was never married. What happens if somebody was married, they have children, and what is the status of the children in that situation?
Right. Well, that's always the worry, right? It's what they call in halachic language, chumra de eshet ish, right? The problem of eshet ish, that she may be still married, right? One of the reasons people don't want to rely on Bitul Kiddushin or things like that I spoke about before is because they'll say, well, what if it doesn't work? Maybe the poskim who say that it doesn't work are right. If they're right, then this woman is still married. And then she goes, she marries somebody else. Not only did she marry someone else unlawfully, now the kids are mamzerim, they're bastard children halachically, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So then how can we be so lenient, right? And things like that. So in the same way, right, in terms of the Edom not being kosher, that is definitely something that you can sometimes rely on in order to invalidate a marriage, sure. You know, people always look at the wedding tape, you know, et cetera, to see what happened there, you know, and figure it out. But you're right, there's like a wariness that always is on the other side, where people always say, we have to be sure, because we don't want a married woman to marry somebody else and the kids and this and that, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It's definitely a concern, but you have to look at all avenues. Look, I'll say something else. People are very worried about the sanctity of the marriage. I understand that, and I understand that they want to make sure that the woman is divorced before she gets remarried. I have to say that you have to worry also about the opposite reaction. There are many people who feel like the rabbinic establishment has let them down. And now they'll just do whatever they want to do. So if we're not stepping up to the plate in order to provide solutions for these individuals, then they're going to search other places. I know people who have decided to forget about Kiddushin completely. In other words, they say, forget this. Why do I need Kiddushin? Kiddushin is what locks me in the marriage. You know, I'm going to get married without Kiddushin. How could you do that? It's not really halachic to do that. Well, they claim that it is halachic, et cetera, et cetera. I don't agree with that. I don't agree that you can marry without Kiddushin. But I know people who are saying, and who are starting to push that more and more. I'll put it to you differently. If you won't supply a couple with Girushin, with divorce, Kedat Moshe v'Yisrael, then they probably won't look for Kiddushin Kedat Moshe v'Yisrael. You know? So, you know, we need to think about how to help people, how to make solutions available to people. You know, because I'm not saying there's a lot of people like this, but I think that, yeah, we're starting to lose people in terms of the system, in terms of, you know, the belief in the system. And it's not because I know that sometimes people think, oh, the system doesn't care. I don't know. I've met a lot of rabbis. I think they care. I think they care about the Aguna issue. But they're not willing to use that care to go the extra mile sometimes and use solutions that are a little bit outside of the box. And once again, I'm not looking for solutions that have no precedent. I'm talking about like Bitul Kiddushin, things that have a lot of precedent. Like you're not willing to rely on Rav Moshe Feinstein. A lot of people are not willing. Yeah. But I think that that's unfortunate. I mean, these are not way out there. And we have to think about who we're losing, you know, to this attitude that is very, very careful. And I understand why, but with all that, to find the solutions so that people have belief and trust in the system. That's very important.
There's some Heter Meir Rabbanim.
Sure.
Is that a loophole?
Heter Meir Rabbanim is for a husband who is an...
It's only for the husband.
If he needs to remarry, so then there's a Heter Meir Rabbanim. That's right. That's right. Today it's really easy to get Meir Rabbanim. Yeah, I have Meir Rabbanim on my phone. It's not so hard. It used to be like a whole challenge to go from city to city and get people to sign and this and that. You know, et cetera. Today it's like you WhatsApp them. And,
but doesn't apply today. She said that's...
Well, Soloveitchik once said that he thinks that we should abolish Heter Meir Rabbanim because if the woman can't get out, the husband should be able to get out either. So, you know, it's an interesting point to that.
He was asking about the status of children born out of wedlock also.
So I think I answered that because I said they're mamzer. I said...
No, not children born out of wedlock. Children that are born if you have an illegal marriage.
Right.
Retroactively, he's asking about the children from the first marriage.
Oh, you mean if we're mevatel the kiddushin?
Yeah.
If we cancel the kiddushin, what's the status of the children? I see. Then the status of the children is okay. So they're not. There's no. They may not be considered the children of married parents. They'll just be considered the children of two Jews who slept together. Mm-hmm. So then, what?
Would the father was a Kohen, would the child still be a son, still be a Kohen?
Yeah. Sure, he's still that father's son, right? But they're just weren't married. So they just consider as if they slept together, so to speak. Okay, so it doesn't change the status of the children. Yeah.
You mentioned three things, and the last one was Avodah Zarah, like that door, I guess.
Giluy Arayot, incense, Shfichu Damim, murder, and Avodah Zarah, idol worship. Yeah.
What happens to a woman that her husband is a Shavuot, it's a hostage?
Yeah.
Israel may know that he is alive or may not. There have been cases like that, and it could drag like 5-7 years or longer.
Right.
What happens to her if she's 20, 24, wants to...
It's a terrible situation, but so long as we know that he's alive... or that we have a doubt that he's alive, she'll be married to him, right? Unless we can somehow annul the marriage or whatever it is, but otherwise she's married to him, yeah. And we've had cases like that, you know, where people have gone missing, abducted, whatever it is, and we didn't know for years, and the wife just kept on waiting and waiting and waiting until someone decided that he's dead, until someone in the army rabbinate looked at the evidence again or whatever it is and decided he's probably dead by now and that's it. You know, if that's so. But that could take many, many years.
Many years.
It could take many, many years, sure.
She is in limbo.
Yep. That's what we're trying to figure out. That's why to sign these things, maybe. Right. That was the reason.
Thank you all so much for coming. You're still in the primary road back under Russian Libya. Feel free to ask some questions, a little bit of food.
Thank you.
Thank you all for coming. Have a great day.
We do have a resumen.
Yes.
Joe, you washed.
Okay, we'll bench. Our Cohen, Gandalf here, and lead us in the benching.
We pass that benching.
Here.
Everybody has a bench.